to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin with our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, holds degrees in biosciences and entomology. And we'll take a look at lots of insects. So we can look at tent caterpillars a bit. We can answer your bug-related questions as well. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And PJ Leash, welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Great to have you back. You know, callers online already, so that I'm sure the calls are starting to increase at the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Definitely, yeah. Usually in about mid to late May, my caseload really starts to take off, and I consider myself to be in full summer mode at that point, and it doesn't really quiet down until about mid-September at the lab.
There we go. So, tent caterpillars, starting to see some of those in the state right now. Talk about those. What do they look like?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple species of tent caterpillars, but the commonest one that people think of our classic tent caterpillar is the eastern tent caterpillar. And these are neat insects because you can actually identify them driving down the road. These are the ones where you're going down a country road, you look out into the woods, and you see that white kind of silken tent webbing, and it's often along where the main trunk meets first couple of branches that come out. And that particular species really loves to feed on things like black cherries and other cherries and crab apples and apples. So some of those types of trees. The caterpillars can get to be almost 2 inches long, dark colored, but they've got a pale whitish stripe running down the middle of their back. But one of the things that's very common with their behavior, and it's really a defensive purpose, is they hide out in that tent, especially during the day, because that protects them from birds and other potential predators that are in there. Then they tend to wander out more at night and feed.
More cosmetic than anything else, or?
Yeah, for the most part. In general, they're probably not going to kill a tree outright, but they can cause some pretty significant defoliation. If that happened to a tree several years in a row, the tree could get stressed. Maybe some secondary insects or diseases could get in there. If you have a tree that's generally healthy, though, even if they get completely defoliated, they've got enough reserves in the plant to send out another batch of leaves, and there's only one generation per year for these tent caterpillars. So once they're done, we don't get a second generation later on in the summer.
So, and what do they turn into?
So they turn into a moth, basically a beige moth. And most folks, if you saw the adults, you probably wouldn't recognize them. They don't have very distinctive features, similar to a lot of other moths. They're just kind of beige and brown. They have some wave-like patterns on the wings, but lots of other moths have somewhat similar color patterns.
Well, here's a sound that we'll probably be hearing pretty quickly. Let's listen to this. Tell me what this is.
Yeah, so we have some of our field crickets, and there's a spring and a fall field cricket. And the spring one, of course, we start to get, right around this time of year or certainly in the near future, and that's really that sound that summer's coming. So I think a lot of folks, when they hear that noise, it brings kind of very warm feelings to them.
Yeah, let's listen to a little. Give me that. Oh, man, you just think sitting on the porch in the evening.
Yeah.
Maybe a cold beer or whatever in hand and listening to those crickets.
Yeah. Yeah. So
wonderful.
Along those lines, there's a really cool website out there where you can find sound clips of that and other insects. And it's kind of neat, you know, if we're in January having a horrible winter storm, you can go and listen to those sounds and it'll improve your mood fairly quickly. It's songsofinsects.com or .org. But if you Google search songs of insects, you should be able to find it. They've got pictures and sound audio clips of crickets and katydids and tree crickets and all kinds of other things.
Very, very cool. Well, you know what? We've quite a few callers here. There's still one line open for you at 800-642-1234, but Pam in Rhinelander's been waiting a bit, so let's go to Pam. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
Okay. We have a cabin in Rhinelander, and I'm not very familiar with pests on the pine trees, but I don't recall seeing these last year, and there are these furry droppings from one of the pine trees. It sort of looks like a caterpillar with a little brown seed on the end of it, and I'm not sure if it's an insect or if it's something from the pine tree. Does that sound familiar?
Well, I mean, when I think of pines and other conifers, like spruces and fir trees up north, there's a very long list of not only caterpillars, but some creatures that look very similar called sawflies that are actually more closely related to ants and bees and wasps. And there's many of those that can feed on pines and other conifers as well. What might be helpful in this case, if you're able to get some decent pictures of the insects and send them to me at the diagnostic lab, that may help us narrow down exactly what particular critter you're dealing with, because there's at this point there's dozens of possibilities.
Okay. All right, great. Thanks for your help.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to John in Madison next. Hi, John.
Hey, good afternoon. So I've always wanted to get honeybees in a place that I could have them. I can't have them no more because they're getting rid of it. So what I'm wondering is, not for my personal use, but just to help the population, am I able to buy honeybees and just let them go and they'll nest themselves with the queen? Like they'll find their own hives in the neighborhood?
Well, in general, I mean, first off, bees are, they can be fairly expensive just to buy. And at this point in the year, you're probably going to have a hard time finding any to purchase anyways. What happens is the beekeepers that have lost hives in the previous year or during the winter months, they're ordering bees months ago. And so a lot of the vendors that are selling bees are already sold out, or they've been sold out for weeks, if not months. So you'd probably have a hard time finding bees to purchase anyways. If you wanted to purchase some for next year, you could get on a list to do that. But again, you'd probably have a hard time buying some this year. There are cases where bees can establish feral colonies. In general, I haven't really heard of anyone trying to just buy bees and let them go. And when you do buy them, they can be fairly expensive. It might be $100, $150 to get a batch of bees anyways. And also what can happen is if those bees get released and they form this conglomeration and they'll sit on a plant or other structure and go out and look for a place to establish their nest. Well, sometimes people will see that, you know, beekeepers, for example, see that and grab those and then put them in a hive box. So if you just release them, there's no guarantee in terms of where they're going to end up.
Probably a better idea or a good idea might be to just plant some plantings and, you know, have a good habitat for bees, and that helps.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of things, if you want to help out bees, that you can do much more easily in your own yard, like putting out flowers, food sources for them. Have a diversity of flowers for not only honeybees, but there's hundreds of other species of wild native bees out in our area, too, that also need those flowers. And some bees can be kind of picky eaters, so to speak. They might only go to one type or family of flowers and not to others. So if we have a variety of flowers blooming throughout the season, that's really a great way to help out bees and other pollinators in area.
I was talking to a beekeeper who had 100 hives and lost about half over the winter, and was telling me that it's extremely hard to find bees. As you were saying, there you know, there's a shortage.
Yes, yes, there. There definitely is, and a lot of beekeepers have been facing very hard winters, and last year we had a lot of summer losses as well, so it's becoming very, very difficult to be a commercial beekeeper. They do have some tricks where they can take colonies and kind of split them, but that basically kind of slows things down a little bit because it takes those colonies a while to get up and running, so to speak.
Let's take another call and go to Stanley, and let's talk to Vern. Hi, Vern. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. We have this problem with what they call ladybugs or Japanese beetles, and some of them now, they bite you on the back of the neck. They're everywhere. You know, they're not real bad yet, but during July, August, September, there's just millions of them outside here. Even in Stanley now, I don't live in Stanley, we're in the country, but, you know, during the late summer, whatever, they get really bad. They hibernate in any place they can find. And yet you could seal your house up, but you can't even go outside. They're so bad.
Asian lady beetles.
What's the government doing about it?
Well, so in general, there's not really any big concentrated effort to do anything with those. And the story with these Asian lady beetles, and they've got a long history going back decades, they had been introduced a couple of times because it turns out they can be beneficial predators of aphids, but they're not very specific in what they feed on, and they'll feed on lots of other insects too. So these had been released basically for biological control, and some of the introductions didn't seem to work, and then all of a sudden, bingo, we've got all these Asian lady beetles around. As you said, they can be very, very active at certain times in the year, especially in late summer and about September, and it depends where you are in the state, but you can get thousands of these things flying around. They use some visual cues if you had contrasting colors. I've had an experience when I was younger where I was wearing a white t-shirt, and man, I was a magnet for those things that afternoon when they were flying around. And as you also mentioned, they like to sneak indoors, and they're really looking for an overwintering spot. So we can seal things up and try and keep them outside. Sometimes folks will spray the exterior of their home with residual insecticide to repel them or kill them before they get in. But overall, there's no concerted effort to really try to manage these things. And they do some bad things when they're sneaking in, or, you know, occasionally they do nip folks. But during the summer months, if they are feeding on, say, aphids in your garden, they're actually beneficial in that regard. So like a lot of things in life, they do some good things, they do some bad things.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Vern. Appreciate it. And let's turn to Joan in Madison next. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. We live on the northeast side of Madison. We've been here for many, many years. And I remember when we first moved in here, we saw grasshoppers. And I haven't seen any anywhere. You go, what happened to the grasshoppers?
So in general, the grasshoppers are around. Now, a couple of things to keep in mind. We've got dozens of different species of grasshoppers in the state, and they all can have slightly different biologies. But many of our grasshoppers spend the winter as eggs down in the soil. And life is hard for a grasshopper. There's all kinds of parasites and predators that may end up eating those eggs. Also, one really important factor with grasshoppers and locusts and things like that, they tend to do better under dry conditions. And so if we had a year like, if you think back to 2012, very droughty, hot, dry year, if we had a couple years in a row like that, we'd probably have a bumper crop of grasshoppers. The last few years, though, it's been quite rainy. And when there's lots of rain, the grasshoppers can actually come down sick with various diseases, and that kills them off. And so if we have lots of rainy years, the grasshoppers get knocked down a bit. If it were dry for a while, they may pop back up. But given the time of the year, you're probably not going to see many grasshoppers right now because, again, of their biology overwintering as eggs. We tend to see more of our adults in mid to late summer. That's when they're reaching maturity.
There we go. Thank you so much, Joan, for calling. And Dave in Bloomer, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just a brand new honeybee, beekeeper, and I'm hearing about this winter kill. Now, is this winter kill, does this pertain to the cold of the winter, or is it a disease in our bees?
Well, it could depend on who you're talking to. Winter kill can just be kind of a vague term sometimes, just referring to beekeepers that had bees that died for a variety of reasons over the winter. Sometimes it might be attributed to a disease. In other cases, it could be the bees didn't have enough fuel sources to basically last through the winter. They didn't have enough food, for example. That could be another reason for it. So there could be a number of reasons why bee colonies might die out during the winter months. In some cases, it could be just the extreme cold.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today, as we visit with P.J. Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab here on the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects today with our guest, P.J. Leash. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. Couple of open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Max emailed to say he recently visited Florida and was overwhelmed by the amount of what Florida natives called love bugs. Apparently, they were a lab-made insect, at least that's the story he heard, to combat mosquitoes. but a fire in the lab accidentally released them into the wild where they duplicated in extreme numbers. What's the likelihood of love bugs making it to Wisconsin?
So I was actually just down in Florida last week, Larry, for a national bark beetle workshop. I did see a few of these love bugs out there. And there's a group, it's a family, Bibionidae, that these flies belong to. And they're really not mosquito predators. At least I haven't heard of them being mosquito predators. And there's lots of native species. We do have members of that family up here in Wisconsin. We don't typically see them in the huge numbers they see sometimes down in Florida. So there's some differences in species there. But there are members of that same group all the way up here in Wisconsin.
Okay. Let's go to John in Wausau next. John, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you, Larry and PJ. Love the show. Two questions. One, I think they're called yellow jackets or bumblebees. They're black and yellow, and they're fuzzy, and they're kind of fat. And I've caught them going into my tuck points of my foundation. I'm wondering if I should do any sort of pest control and then have the tuck pointing done. And then the other one is I've got grubs in my front lawn. I've never had them before, but it looked like somebody was digging a treasure map in my front yard, and I'm wondering what to do about those.
Okay.
So let's start with the black and yellow things, and you had described them as pretty large and fuzzy, which would make me think more of bumblebees. And at this point in the year, yellow jackets are out and active, but they're, you know, in pretty low numbers.
Yeah,
right
pretty low right now.
Yeah. The story with bumblebees, though, and you very well could have bumblebees, is they are cavity nesters. So they like to find some type of pre-existing cavity. And this is often a burrow, like an old chipmunk burrow, a hollow cavity in a compost pile or under a flower pot or under some tree roots, under a tree, for example. If you do have an opening on the side of your house that leads to some type of cavity or wall void, they could potentially get into a spot like that as well. Now, if things are sealed up on the inside so that the bees aren't coming all the way into the house, that's one thing. If they are getting into the basement, you know, then you're probably not too happy about that. With bumblebees, though, it's pretty hard to remove them and really relocate them. And often just trying to do that disturbs the nest enough that they're probably not going to survive anyways. If need be, there are some insecticide dust that could be used. But again, bumblebees are beneficial creatures who don't want to try and have to take them out if we don't have to. If it's on a corner of the house that you just don't spend a whole lot of time near, bumblebees tend to be fairly docile unless you get really close to the nest. You could consider leaving them. If it's in a spot on the house that's right next to the back deck where you barbecue or the kids play and there's a lot more human interaction, you might have to intervene in a case like that.
You could wait until, if it's not a problem, you could wait till fall, and then I'd do the tuck pointing, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So with bumblebees, they do die out. That colony dies out in the fall. So again, if it's in a spot where there's not a whole lot of foot traffic or pets aren't going to get there, and you can just wait it out and do the tuck pointing later in the year once they've died out, that could be a possibility.
What about those grubs that are in the lawn? And the way John described it, it sounded like maybe a skunk or something was digging into the lawn to find them.
Yeah, so I suspect that's probably what is going on, Larry. When it comes to grubs and lawns, there is a number of different species. Given your location in Wausau area, I suspect you're probably seeing the grubs of Japanese beetles. We can also get similar looking grubs from May June beetles and a few other species, although those tend to be a bit more hit or miss or restricted to other spots in the state. Last year, Japanese beetle pressure was extremely high. Yeah. Lots of adults out. They were, you know, feeding on all kinds of different plants. And the females of Japanese beetles specifically like to go to low-cut irrigated turf grass to lay eggs. So they lay eggs, the grubs hatch and feed. So these grubs, they are indeed Japanese beetles, which I suspect they probably are. They would have been in the ground since about last July or August, feeding. If we knew we were going to have grubs and we intervened then, we can get pretty good control. The problem with the time of the year right now, the grubs are pretty much at their maximum size, and so they're going to be harder to kill, and also they're going to turn into pupae pretty soon anyways. And they don't feed as the pupal stage, and eventually they're going to turn into the adult Japanese beetle. So there are technically some curative grub control products you can get at the hardware store, Grubex and things along those lines, and some other products that can kill grubs in theory. But again, this time of the year, we tend to not get very good control. If we know we're going to have grubs or suspect we might, if we target that in about early July, we can really prevent a lot of damage. But once the grubs are in there, and as Larry mentioned, vertebrates find them, skunks and raccoons and turkeys. If you're far enough north, bears potentially could even dig up your lawn to feed on the grubs. Sometimes folks jokingly call them lawn shrimp because they can be a good protein source for animals. I've seen cases where it can look like someone's gone through the yard with a rototiller. Because they get in there and they feed at night and it looks awful.
We've gotten some photos from folks over the years of lawns. Look at this lawn. And you're right, it looks like a rototiller went through. But
given the time of the year, again, as I said, you could try some of the curative grub control products. Otherwise, I would maybe focus more on reseeding those areas that have been damaged. If things dry down, making sure the lawn gets enough irrigation so it can recover. And then if we're expecting beetle pressure again this year or grubs, if you use some of the preventative treatments in about early July, that offers much better results than trying to target them right now.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, John. It's Ellie in Milwaukee. It's your turn. Hi, Ellie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's a great program. This last year I've been studying more about native bees and their plight, that they only live 1 year and they're having trouble finding nectar plants and nesting plants. And so I would want to encourage people to go to maybe smaller garden centers and find some native plants to help them out. And it's really been very enjoyable that I've found that I had an emerging queen, Bimulatus, I think, the two-spot queen, come to my yard to eat to nectar on the Virginia bluebells, which I originally put in to attract hummingbirds. But she's been back several days in a row, and it's been quite fun to watch her going from flower to flower.
Yeah, that sounds like a great situation there. And as you were talking about earlier, PJ, if you have those natives that are blooming at different times of the year, you'll keep those things coming back.
Yes, yes. You can really attract a very wide diversity of bees. When the crabapple, for example, in my front yard blossoms, which it should be doing in the next few days, I've gone out and in a five-minute span counted probably a dozen or more different species of bees. So if you have the flowers out, the bees will come and find it. And just to follow up on the comment about native plants, I do recommend from the bees' point of view to try and go with those native plants. If you go to the garden center and you're picking out these flashy, very trendy annuals, for example, and other cultivars, sometimes those plants have been bred to be attractive to the human eye. They might have extra petals and things like that. Those plants might actually not have a whole lot of nectar or pollen for the insects. And so you're putting plants out there thinking you're helping the bees. Well, those bees have evolved with the native plants to our area. So if you give them the food they're used to, that's probably going to be the best for them in the long run.
Yeah. Thanks again, Ellie, for calling. Fred in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Fred.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. In the Madison area, we've been seeing these brown murmurated stink bugs in low numbers, both in homes and other places the last few years. And I've read a little bit about how bad those an infestation of brown murmurated stink bugs can be in peak conditions. And I wondered if your guest could provide a forecast for us about what to expect with that insect and how we might prepare for it. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you for calling. PJ, what do you think?
So the brown marmorated stink bug, I've got a bad feeling about this one. So we first picked it up in the state, almost 7-8 years ago already. And it was really quiet for a few years until we hit about 2015, I would say, was the tipping point. That year we had about three dozen reports. in 2016, we had our first evidence that they were really reproducing and breeding in the state. We're finding juveniles and mating adults. Prior to that, we weren't even sure, were they able to survive the winter or were they just getting transported back up here? But we now know they're breeding here in the state, able to survive pretty well in our area. And I've just been seeing their numbers increase the last several years. At this point, I've had reports in Madison area in particular is one of the worst spots in the state. And it's not uncommon to find a dozen or more of them in your house. In some of our worst cases, though, folks have had 100 or more and maybe up to 1,000 or more of these down in Janesville, Beloit area. Looking into my crystal ball, my best guess is we're probably going to start seeing more and more of these. And at the moment, the hot spots in the state are really Dane County and Rock County all the way over to the southeastern part, to Milwaukee, Waukesha, Racine, Kenosha. Lots of pressure in that part of the state. And then also the Fox River Valley and kind of the western edge of Lake Winnebago, Fond du Lac all the way up to Green Bay. Lots of reports, and it's starting to spread outwards from those areas. So unfortunately, the forecast doesn't look very favorable for these. I think we're going to start seeing lots more of them in the coming years. And in terms of pests that sneak indoors in the fall, we think of things like box elder bugs and Asian lady beetles. I think this one might become our top fall invader at some point.
Ugh. Well, on that happy note, let's take another call. Todd in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Todd.
Yes, this is in reference to the individual that wanted to just get some bees and release them. My wife last year, I actually contacted a beekeeper. I'm a cabinet maker, and I did work for her, and she was interested in mentoring somebody, and she ended up mentoring my wife, and that seems like a great way to go. So Ann's partaking. She's learning all the knowledge of beekeeping, which is just amazing, really, to me, too. So I think that's a great alternative, and the beekeepers are looking for people that want to help, too. So I think it's a win-win situation there.
I like that idea, Todd. Thank you so much for calling. It sounds like great advice to me, BJ.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and that kind of slipped my mind earlier, but a lot of beekeepers might not have the room in their backyard to keep them, or they've got a small yard or something like that, and they might keep them elsewhere, you know, on a friend's property that's got a couple acres or something like that. But if you're interested in beekeeping, a lot of spots in the state have local beekeeping clubs you can get associated with, and a lot of times experienced beekeepers are really quite happy to, you know, teach folks the tricks of the trade, so to speak.
Good advice. Let's go to Dave in Janesville next. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. I've got a Polyphemus cocoon, and I'm trying to get it to hatch at a time it would coincide with the mating season, since they're getting so rare. Sitting in a jar right now. Any tricks?
What are we talking about there, PJ?
Yeah, so Polyphemus moth is one of our giant silk moths, and we've got a handful or so of these really big moth species in the state. Polyphemus is probably the commonest one that I see, and luckily with that one, it's got a fairly long season. I have seen Polyphemus moths out in June, and I've had reports of them into August as well. So really, they can be active for a fairly long period of time. The adult moths typically not live that long, because they can be a good meal for a bat or other creature that might want to eat them. In general, what I would do, and I guess a quick question for you, Dave, what did you do with it during the winter? Did you bring it indoors or was it outdoors?
No, it was in a shed.
Okay. Okay, that's what I was hoping to hear. Sometimes folks get them and think they're doing them a favor by bringing moth cocoons indoors. And with some species of moths and butterflies, too, if they actually don't experience a period of cold during the winter, they may not develop properly. So the best thing is to put them in a sheltered spot exactly like you did. I would probably take that container and maybe put it to a location outside where it's still enclosed in the container and a little bit of air can get in, and just watch it every day and see. And if that moth pops out, release it. But I'd say we're getting to that time of the year where there could be others of the same species out there and active.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And Mona in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Mona.
Hi there. I just tuned in when you were talking about that it's best for these bees to have the native plants. And not really, I mean, I guess I'm not asking you this. I'm saying, what are your thoughts on this, on banning something like killing off all these dandelions where people have to have their golf course lawns and, you know, they want the pretty flowers, but they don't want dandelions are ugly or something. But I think it'd be great if they would ban that stuff. I think it would, that alone would help a lot of stuff.
Thank you for calling, Mona. What do you think, PJ?
So when it comes to things like dandelions and other plants that folks might consider weeds, but if it's a plant with a flower, it's going to be making some nectar and pollen. And we do know that bees and other pollinators like flies and certain beetles and things like that will go to some of these non-native weeds that can be very common in our lawns. Things like dandelions would be an example.
Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, things like that. The clovers in lawns can be pretty good for pollinators as well. And so there's been this movement the last couple years that some folks are just letting their lawn go to more of a wild state where you leave some of these weeds and you're not as... not as much of a stickler for weed control. And researchers down in Kentucky took a look at plants like dandelions and found that if you observe dandelions in a lawn, you can easily get 50 or more species of bees and other pollinators that will show up and use those plants. So again, just in general, the more flowers we have out there, that's probably going to help bees and other pollinators in the long run.
Yeah. Thank you, Mona, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Emily emailed to say Rose Chafers, the beetles, decimated her young apple trees last season. What are your recommendations for control?
So when it comes to rose chafers, if you're not familiar with these, rose chafers are kind of our native version of the Japanese beetle. They feed on a lot of the same plants. They can cause very similar damage. A couple of differences, though, they're active about a month earlier. So the rose chafers are basically active in about late May until maybe early July, and we only find them in parts of the state with sandy soil. So if you're near the Wisconsin River, Central Sands portion of the state, and some other areas with sandy soil, you'll see these. If you're outside of that area, you've maybe never heard of them. So they can be very restricted in where they are in Wisconsin. In terms of protection, we can do a lot of the same tactics we do for Japanese beetles, and it depends a little bit on the plant. We do have some both organic and conventional sprays that can be used. There might be some options in terms of physically excluding the insects. So if you have a small plant that you might be able to put a mesh netting over, a row cover, that can be an option to protect certain plants. And then one difference between the rose chafers and Japanese beetles, with Japanese beetles, I typically don't recommend those pheromone traps, the green and yellow ones.
Yeah.
You often make things worse because you're drawing them in from long distance. I've seen with the rose chafers, there are some specific rose chafer traps that are hard to find. You usually can't find them at the hardware store. You can order them online through companies like Great Lakes IPM, but those may help a little bit as well. Now, looking at the timing here in mid-May, those beetles are going to be out pretty soon in the next couple of weeks. So if you want those pheromone traps, you'd have to hop online and order some in the near future to try them out.
We have Eliana from Evansville up next. Hi, Eliana. How are you?
Good.
Good. What's on your mind today?
How everything we have, how the ants coming to our kitchen, how do we get rid of them?
Got some small ants. Are they in the house, Eliana?
Yeah.
Oh, they're in the house. Well, I've got a few ants in my house, too, as a matter of fact, just starting to see them. What's up here?
Yeah, so it's just the time of the year. I'm starting to see lots and lots of reports of ant activity, and there's a handful of very common species that like to sneak indoors. When it comes to ants, especially when they sneak indoors, often one of the approaches we use is to use ant baits. And this is basically a type of food that is mixed with a substance that is going to kill the ants. And what they do is they collect the bait, they bring it back to the colony, and they share it with the other ants, and then the colony dies out. Now, with ants, they tend to be kind of picky eaters. They either like sugars or they like more of a protein or fat-based food. So one thing you could do for starters is cut out some little bits of newspaper or wax paper and put out a dollop of something sweet like honey or corn syrup, and then a little bit of maybe peanut butter, for protein and fat, and see what type they like. And if we can figure out what type of food they like, then we can go to a hardware store and find the right type of bait for those sugar-based ants or for the protein-based ants.
So you got a little research project there, Eliana. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Always nice to have our younger listeners calling in. Let's go to Jim in Muskego next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I have an asparagus patch, and every year I get these beetle-like insects that are usually towards the top of the spear, and they'll chew on a spear. And then if I let the fronds or let the smaller ones grow up, they'll be on the fronds too. And as soon as you touch the spear, they fall to the ground right away. And they're about a quarter inch long. I believe they're striped. I'm not in front of them right now, but I believe they have a stripe on the back.
Okay.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, so there are actually, there's two creatures out there that we commonly bump into, and we call them asparagus beetles. There's one that has spots on it, one that has more of stripes on the body. Very similar biologies, they cause very similar damage as well, and they're associated with asparagus. Now, in terms of dealing with them, there's a couple options. There are conventional and organic sprays that can be done. If you have a small patch, you might be able to do enough with hand picking, or you could potentially spray them, try some insecticidal soap or soapy water. One other thing that might help, because the larvae will also feed on the plants, and they're more these little grub-like creatures, but you can actually identify the eggs of these beetles fairly easily. They're tiny, about a 16th of an inch long, and little black things, and they stick out perpendicular to the asparagus spears or stems on the plants. And if you can find those, you can just wipe them off with a damp, soapy paper towel or something like that, and that may help cut down on the numbers in the future. If you'd like more information, there's a really good fact sheet we have available on the UW Extension Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu. And if you just search for asparagus beetle, we've got a fact sheet that'll talk a lot more in depth about the control approaches that you can take.
And thanks again for that call. Appreciate it. We got an email from someone, and this goes back to the love bug issues. Gary emailed, he checked out the story on Snopes about the love bugs and how they actually got into the U.S. They were stowaways on a ship, arrived in either Galveston or New Orleans around 1920. They migrated into Florida in 1947 from Louisiana, looked around like what they saw and decided to stay. Their natural capacity for reproduction took care of the rest. So there wasn't some experiment gone wrong. So it's good to get that cleared up. Thanks for emailing that into us. Well, talking the world of insects today with our guest PJ Leash. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking about all kinds of insects here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Lots of callers online, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Colin in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Colin.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm in my car. I deliver about 540 papers in a day, and I am finding that the paper, if I put it in, it's like a plastic tube.
Yeah.
And just about every other one, these are country routes, so just about every one of them has a little nest being built by, I think it's the wasp. And I...
Shut the door.
And so here we've got Colleen, a newspaper deliverer, and she's got these tubes that she puts the papers in, and they've got some wasps that are building nests inside?
Yeah, so I suspect what might be happening, there's a creature, one of her paper wasps, called the European paper wasp, and it's rather fond of getting into cavities sometimes. And I've had these get underneath... the weather stripping trunks of cars and get into backs of cars under gas caps and locations like that. Now, some good news about these is They try to establish colonies this time of year, and if you can kind of stop them now and shut the door, that can help quite a bit in preventing that nest from building up larger in size. So perhaps something that you could maybe try in this case, if you were to just type up notes on a little piece of paper and maybe rubber band them to the newspaper and say, I noticed a paper wasp nest in your tube. Would you be willing to take care of it? I mean, if you get in there with a can of wasp spray, that would be able to take care of it pretty quickly. Maybe even a heavy spraying with soapy water, especially when the colonies are small right now. But again, if you take care of it right now when the colonies are small, that should help prevent issues later on in the summer when there's going to be a lot more wasps present.
All right. So you need to put a little note.
Yeah, that's maybe something to try in this case.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Good luck with that. On to Tom in Peshtigo next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I got a couple questions about fireflies. What time of year are they out? Because it seems kind of sporadic, but maybe I'm just not paying attention. And which ones light up, and what are they really?
Sure. So first off, fireflies are actually a type of beetle. There's a family, Lampyridae, which are the fireflies. There are species in that group that don't light up, and sometimes you can find those various times of the year. I've found some overwintering beneath the barks of trees and things like that. What people commonly think of as fireflies, though, are the ones we see during the summer months, because they're lighting up and flashing, and that's really a way for them to communicate with potential mates in most cases. And for us, the peak period of fireflies is probably about mid-June into about early August. So July is probably the best month for viewing fireflies, although it depends a little bit on your location in the state and the species that you have present. It turns out that there are dozens of firefly species in our area. They can have different emergence times in terms of when they're active in the year. They can have slight differences in terms of how early or late they're active, when sundown is coming. They'll also differ in their biologies and life cycles and flash patterns and flash colors and things like that. There's a couple really good books out there about fireflies if you'd like to know more, but there's a lot of intricacies when you start talking about all those different species that are out there.
Yeah, I interviewed the author of a book on fireflies, and he was telling about some fireflies. It's over on the East Coast in one of the national or state parks, where they actually synchronize, that they light up at exactly the same time and shut off, and then light up again at the same time and shut off. I saw a video of it, and it was amazing.
Yeah, it is really amazing. I have seen some clips as well, and if I remember correctly, that's down around Great or Smoky Mountain.
Is that where it is?
Park.
Okay,
yeah.
I couldn't remember exactly.
And it can be a big draw because tourists, it comes out at a very particular time, and the park, you know, regulates parking and things like that, and a lot of people can flow in to see those. I've never seen it personally, but the video clips are really cool for those synchronous fireflies.
Yeah, they really are. Tom, thanks very much. Appreciate your call. We turn to Carrie in Douseman next. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I get these little millipede, like worm-like bugs in my basement every spring, and they're like just a couple inches long. And if they're not alive, they just like curl up, you know, and you find them dead on the floor. But for some reason this year, that we just have a ton of them. And, you know, at certain times they emit this horrible smell. Like if you disturb them, they just emit this horrible smell. And I'm just wondering what they are and why they might be worse this year, and I'm just curious.
Sure. So there's a lot of different species of millipedes out there, but in general, millipedes are associated with damp conditions, and they feed on things like decomposing plant leaves and decomposing plant matter and fungal spores and things like that. So, I mean, a good place to find millipedes, a place like a compost pile, a rotting log, really rich mulch beds and things like that. Why you're probably seeing more of them this year is it's been rainy, especially last year. We had lots and lots of rain. And it's been rainy the last couple years in general. So millipedes have had good conditions. Sometimes what happens is at night they can wander surprisingly long distances. They could easily go 50 or 100 yards in some cases. And as the sun comes up, they don't like to be out in the sun, so they may be trying to find shelter. They can sneak through window wells in the basement that maybe don't seal up the best, or other nooks and crannies and cracks and crevices. When they get indoors, it's really a dead end for them. It's way too dry for them to survive. They need those moist conditions. So often what happens is if they get indoors, they probably die in a few days anyways, and they often curl up in that spiral shape. In terms of the scent that they emit, these millipedes, because they're feeding on decomposing stuff and they walk pretty slowly, their main defense is if a predator disturbs them, many species release these noxious chemicals as a defensive purpose, and sometimes some of those chemicals might smell bad to us.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Mickey in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have some anthills in my yard and in my flower beds, and I would like to try and at least get them to move out. I don't mind having three of them because they're in the plant beds, and I've kind of made an area for them. I know the birds kind of use them once in a while to get clean. So they're a good thing to have, but now they're making so many other spaces in my other, in my lawn. How do I get rid of them without poisoning everything and,
sure,
I don't know, just getting them out?
Sure. And a question for you, how large are these ant mounds? Are they, you know, just a few inches across, or are they large, like dinner plate size or larger?
Pretty much like a dinner plate size at this point. Yeah.
Okay.
They're not little itty bitty ones.
Okay. I mean, when it comes to ants in the state, we've got dozens and dozens of different species. There's a group out there we call the field ants, and they tend to make these very large mounds. And you can bump into them in lawns where the nest might be the size of a dinner plate. Sometimes out in the woods, you get nests that can be several feet across and really, really big, and those ants can be fairly aggressive in terms of defending their colony as well. Now, the trick to eliminating these, though, is the bulk of the ants are below ground. They can be below ground a couple feet. So what we often need to do is to use an insecticide. And the thing with this is we're not broadcasting it all over the place. We're applying it just to a discrete area to knock out that nest. And it's not like we're putting it all over our yard. But what you have to do with these, because the colony can be located well below ground, is poke channels down into the soil to get the stuff to soak in, and use a liquid type formulation we can mix with a bunch of water, drench it in, and get it to soak it down into soil. That's how we take care of field ants.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. On the subject of ants, Carrie emailed to say that she found literally thousands of dead tiny ants in her horse run, I think horse barn. They weren't there yesterday. No chemicals were added. Nothing was done. She's wondering why thousands of ants would die overnight.
Well, what I wonder might have happened in this case, certain ants at a point in their life cycle produce winged, basically kings and queens, the swarmers that emerge in very, very large numbers. Many of them aren't going to make it all that long, and so there can be a lot of them that die pretty quickly. So if the ants had wings on their body, that's what I suspect had happened, is you had an emergence of these wing swarmers, a lot of them died, and that would explain why you found so many in such a short amount of time.
Sam in Burlington, your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I had a comment about Japanese beetles, and I'm wondering if PJ can tell me if I'm fooling myself. I planted several fruit trees a few years back, and especially the cherries, they just love them. And pretty soon now, they're going to be congregating on them, if it holds true like the last few years. So the first year, I can't remember, I sprayed them with something that somebody told me would work well, and it seemed to. But it seemed to, it did affect the leaves on the trees. I mean, I got a little crop of cherries, and it wasn't bad. But so the second year, I hit them with something, more of a dish soap kind of a concoction that I sprayed.
Yep.
And after a couple times, they gave up and they stopped coming back. And maybe I just coated the leaves off, or I don't know what I did. But, again, it seemed to affect the leaves. I don't know if it was fogging up the pores in the leaves, but they just were kind of a little curly and just didn't look happy. They just looked, and they weren't getting water. I mean, it had to kind of look like it wasn't getting watered, but they were.
Yeah, there we go. What do you think, PJ?
Well, when it comes to controlling adult Japanese beetles, I mean, there are conventional and organic sprays that can be used. Insecticidal soap can work to a certain extent, but once the soap dries, it stops working. You might be able to dislodge them with water. One complication with that is that if you are regularly spraying with water to knock the beetles off, and you're keeping those leaves damp, you might be encouraging fungal diseases on the plant. And so that could cause a lot of secondary issues. You're doing that. So I typically wouldn't, think of using water very regularly to dislodge the adult beetles. But again, there's a lot of both conventional and organic sprays that can be used to protect the leaves from the beetle feeding. One thing that might help is if you, stay on top of things early, and those beetles start popping out about 4th of July. But if you can prevent some of that initial plant damage and the plant isn't releasing volatile chemicals to attract more beetles, that might help too. So if you just have a few fruit trees and you're really diligent with hand picking and other things, that can help in the long run.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate your call very much. We have, Mimi emailed for the listener with a polyphemus cocoon, should sprinkle it with water once a week, which is probably a pretty good idea, too. PJ Leash, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in, number 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll be back with PJ right after the news. Stay with us. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, Larry Mueller here. PJ, of course, directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Always fun to have him come by. And certainly, if you have questions, maybe there's an unusual bug that you've seen you have a question about, or maybe there's a problem bug that you want to wonder how to deal with, give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Love to hear from you. Let's go back to the phones. Bonnie in Sauk County up next. Bonnie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about wasps. Last year, I was severely stung by wasps, and badly enough that I ended up in the hospital. I have been told that wasps come back to the same spot. I don't know exactly where they were, but I don't know what to do to prevent this.
They don't normally come back to the same spot, do they, PJ? Well, they wouldn't be the same wasps anyway, would they?
Right. It wouldn't be the same wasps. So what happens is with yellow jackets and paper wasps, the colony basically dies out in the fall due to starvation and the frost when they come. Certain females from the colony will overwinter in sheltered locations, and then those females have to start the nests from scratch, and they generally don't go back to the old nests. And one reason for that may be that a nest from last year might have died out from disease or parasite. If you go back to the same nest, it could potentially be there. So they instead tend to start nests from scratch. In terms of preventing these insects, that can be really hard to do because there's lots of different species and they have different habits in terms of where they like to go to establish nests. One general piece of advice, though, keep an eye out, especially this time of year in the next month or so, because if you see a small nest that is being started, at first it's just the queen. She's got to do all the work. Eventually she's going to raise more and more workers that do the bulk of the work for her, and she stays in the nest and lays eggs. But if you catch the nest when it's small and take it out when it's small, then it never gets to that big size. If you don't notice a nest and it gets to be August, September, some of those yellow jacket nests can have hundreds or thousands of workers, which could be potentially dangerous if you disturb that and they all come out and sting you. But again, if you catch it early this time of the year and you're vigilant and you kind of shut the door on them now, that can prevent those very large, potentially dangerous nests later on in the year.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Steve in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thank you for calling, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I just wanted to comment on ways to get rid of bugs that you don't want around your house. I find that the tool manufacturers make these cordless vacuum cleaners that run off of batteries. You can walk out. around the house, I walk around and just vacuum them up. Yeah. And it's amazing how few you find after several years of doing this.
Yeah, makes sense to me, PJ.
Yeah, there's a lot of non-chemical ways that you can go about dealing with insects, especially, and a good example would be in a case of something along the lines of box elder bugs. If you know every year you have box elder bugs on the side of your house, you could go out there and just spray them with soapy water, for example, and kind of take them out that way. Or you could go around with a portable vacuum or take the hose attachment of the vacuum cleaner and suck them up, and you can really get rid of a lot of insects in a fairly short period of time doing that.
Thanks very much for that call. And, oh, we have some open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Give a call. So looking at identifying a caterpillar and what it might turn into, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. So a lot of folks are pretty familiar with caterpillars already. I did mention earlier in the show a creature called a sawfly when we had the caller with worms on her conifer tree, and those can look somewhat similar. A true caterpillar is going to be this worm-like creature. It's going to have a head capsule. It's going to have three pairs of true legs on the thorax, and then caterpillars have these fleshy, blobby structures we call prolegs. They're not true hardened jointed legs. Most caterpillars are going to have about four or five pairs of these, whereas sawflies will have about seven pairs of these.
Okay.
Another technical difference is if you were to take that creature and look at it under the microscope, on caterpillars, those prolegs on the body have these little teeny tiny hooks on them. It would remind you exactly of Velcro. We call those crochets. And that's one of the reasons if you ever have a caterpillar on your hand and you're trying to get it off, sometimes it sticks on there.
Yeah.
It's got literally little Velcro hooks on their body. Some caterpillars also have fewer prolegs. If you think of our inchworm caterpillars, the way that they move, they're missing some of those prolegs on the body. So those are some clues. When it comes to identifying caterpillars, though, a lot of the time we just look at the creature, and in many cases they have very distinct color patterns or presence of spines or spikes or something like that. And there's some really good caterpillar identification guides out there. One of my favorite is, I believe, from Princeton is the publishing company for it, and it's for caterpillars of eastern North America. But there's some really good field guides out there to identifying caterpillars that can be helpful, too.
Let's take another call. Danelle in Madison, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hello. My question is about box elder bugs.
Yeah.
I was cleaning out my hosta bed, just a plain old green workhorse hosta, and I found box elder bugs crawling in and around all over the bed, and I'm wondering what I can do with them.
Sure. So what I would wonder, because box elder bugs spend the winter in sheltered locations, and so I am a little bit suspicious they might have been under the siding of your home or something like that, and they may just be coming out of those areas and starting to become active for the year. So what you could do in this case, because you found them and caught them early, you could even potentially consider spraying them with soapy water and take out those box elder bugs now. Rather than if you let them go, they might start reproducing on plants in the yard, and they could build up their numbers through the year.
I was thinking about those leaves. Those hosta leaves are generally pretty big. Would they hide under them for the winter or too cold?
Potentially. I wouldn't think of that as a great overwintering spot.
Okay.
Unless, you know, if you had enough snow, potentially. They tend to like to get under siding of homes, beneath the bark of dead trees and logs, rock piles, things like that. I'd say it's a possibility, especially if it were on, say, the south-facing side of a home where you get more sun. Yeah, it might be sheltered enough there that they could.
Thanks again, Danelle. Jody and Merrill, your turn now. Hi, Jody. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I got a general question. I was driving semi about 3 years ago, and I heard a big thud. Actually, I was team driving. And I looked on the windshield at night, and there's a big, looks like a praying mantis. Are they common in Wisconsin, and where are they usually located?
Sure. Praying mantis.
Yeah, so overall, they're not common in Wisconsin. They do better in more southern locations. If you go to some of the southern states, they can be fairly common down there. We have two species that pop up from time to time in our area, European mantis and the Chinese mantis. I did notice in 2017, for example, a lot more reports of praying mantids. Turns out mantids tend to lay their eggs in very exposed locations, on twigs and gardening stakes. And so in Wisconsin, our winters are often cold enough that it's going to kill off those eggs, which is why we don't really have many of them. One spot in the state we tend to see more of them would be the southeast corner. So I went to undergrad at UW Parkside, and down in Kenosha County, you could bump into praying mantids with some regularity. Farther north you get, they get scarcer and scarcer. But in the state, they tend to be the southeast corner. And then sometimes up along the Lake Michigan shore up to Door County, we get some reports on occasion. But not very common if you do bump into them.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Jody, for calling. On to Paul in Reidsville. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, good afternoon. Long-time listener, second-time caller. I live up in Manitowoc County, and I have the Branch River running through my property. And I have tree plantation on both sides of the river. I have a mature forest with white pine and black walnut existing on the south bank, and pine trees that were planted in 1999 on the north bank. Something is burrowing into my white pine trees and killing them. More so the not quite as mature ones and actually the smaller ones. And I noticed that they're not burrowing into the black walnut, thank God. But I did notice that they are killing some of the other scrub, like hardwood trees, like oak and elm and stuff like that. Not a lot of them, but something is burrowing into them. And I want to know what you know and if there's anybody I can have come out here and look at my trees, because I'm really worried about whatever is burrowing in is going to get across the river and start digging them.
Yeah. So when it comes to pines, like white pines, I mean, there's a list of insects that can get in and to burrow into the trees. Most of those insects, though, are what I would term secondary pests, where they're going to leave healthy trees alone, and they're going to get into trees that are stressed. And that stress could be from a variety of sources. It could be disease, soil compaction, extremes of weather, too hot or too rainy, or things like that. So there could be a lot of reasons for that. I guess I'm wondering a little bit, if you're seeing where these insects are, or something's boring in, what do the holes look like? Are they round, oval? How big are they? Are they in rows at all?
They're round, and they're not in rows. They're staggered.
Okay.
And it appears to they're attacking the bottom of the trunks.
Okay.
From the trees.
And how big are the holes?
I would say a quarter inch or a little bit bigger than that.
Okay. Yeah, so that would sound definitely like an insect. One thing I was kind of reaching for, there are actually some birds, like yellow-bellied sapsucker, that can make rows of holes, and it often gets mistaken for insect damage, but it's got another cause, and sometimes it can cause some significant declines on trees. What I would maybe do in your case is if you're able to snap some pictures of the insect holes on the bark and get them to me at the diagnostic lab, I'll do a little bit of digging. There are some longhorn beetles that can get into the trees. There's also some insects from the bark beetle group. My suspicion, though, is that it's probably one of these secondary borers, and there's not a whole lot we can do about those. And what that would indicate or suggest is that the trees were probably stressed at one point. It could have been some of our weather patterns, extreme winters, drought, and sometimes it can have occurred a couple years ago, and then the insect damage shows up later on at some point. So that's a possibility. I'm suspicious of some of these secondary borers.
Yeah. And there are DNR foresters as well who sometimes can come out and take a look.
Yeah, I forgot about that aspect of it, Lori. So in terms of having someone else out to look at the trees, DNR forester, possibly an arborist in your area might be someone else that could take a peek at it as well.
Yeah, so your local DNR office, give them a call, and that might help too. But I like your idea about the photos and send them to you, and hopefully you can come up with an answer.
Yeah, sometimes there's clues from the type of pitch coming out from the holes and things like that, but I think some pictures would be a good next step for us.
All right. Good luck, Paul. Thanks for calling. And Tim in Exeland, your term. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Larry. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So the question I have is regarding what's on the outside of my home. So there's a bunch of different spots on the outside, and they're always about the size of the head of a pin. They're usually brown or black in nature, and it doesn't seem to be variant in terms of what sun exposure my home has. They're putting these things all over my cabin. So the question becomes is that, one, I don't know how to identify what's causing this. They don't look like egg sacs. I mean, they don't hatch or do anything. Like I said, and it's like if somebody threw glued pepper against your home, that's the way it appears. And yeah, they're only about the size of the head of a pin, and they're not very large in terms of how far off the surface they protrude. But cleaning them off every year is going to be a pain. I'm trying to find out if there's any bug that I can eliminate.
They're hard to clean, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I suspect that the cause of this problem doesn't have insects at the root of it. It turns out there is a fungus out there called the artillery fungus, and it can actually create these little spore globules or packets that it can fire up into the air to disperse the spores, and sometimes it might fire them, you know, 10 or more feet potentially. And these fungi can be fairly common on things like bark mulch and things like that that are often placed around homes. And if those fungi are present, they keep shooting these little spore blobs onto the side of your house, and they can be kind of tough to clean off, especially if they dry and get kind of baked on by the sun. So it can be kind of frustrating.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Tim. And Kathy and Merrill, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I had a carpenter ant infestation about 3 years ago, and I ended up having to have a lot of repair done on my house. Since then, I've had an insect company come and spray about once every 3 months, and I'm wondering if I need to keep that up still, or since I haven't been seeing any kind of recurrence, if I could stop now.
Yeah, I guess a question for you, Kathy. So it sounded like the nest originally might have been indoors because you might have had some soft wood replaced. Is that correct?
Yeah, what happened was there was a leak around a chimney, and so they got in the sidewall.
Okay.
And originally, the previous owner had stored firewood in the garage, which I took out and cleaned everything up. But, got a lot of damage to them.
Okay. Well, and with carpenter ants, you know, we can get indoor nests where there's soft water or in some other situations, and then we can also get outdoor nests, and sometimes the ants from outdoor nests wander indoors. In your case, it sounded like you had that water-damaged wood, so you had that taken out and repaired. That's an important step. I would say in a case like this, you could consider, holding off and just observing. Because if that work you had done got rid of that soft wood and you took care of the nest, that might be the end of it. If you don't have any sprays done for a while and you start seeing carpenter ants, then I would do some detective work and watch them and see, are they coming from an indoor source? And sometimes you can just watch the ants and observe and see where their trail leads to. Or are they going from an outdoor source where you could have a stump or rotting log outside? That's the ultimate source. If you're not seeing any more indoors, I would say, you can hold off in the future. If you stop the treatments and then see, the carpenter ants are back, do some detective work, and you might need to have the pest control company back out at that point. But I'd say given your situation, it would be perfectly fine to kind of wait and observe for the time being.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's go to Kathy in Hartford. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Every year I grow moonflowers, and by about August, I usually end up finding a huge green caterpillar, and it's like 4 or more inches long, and it has a spike on it, and I was wondering if that's a tomato hornworm, and if so, is there anything beneficial to that? I've never found them on my tomatoes, but I didn't know if that's something I should dispatch or if they have any beneficial value.
Sure. So four plants in that group, from the tomato family and related plants, there are a number of hornworm species that can show up, tomato hornworm and tobacco hornworm, and there may even be a few others in that. But it definitely sounds like a hornworm caterpillar with that kind of spike on the back end. They can get to be large size, sometimes a couple inches, and it can be sometimes hit or miss. If those moonflowers are a ways away from the tomatoes, you might not have them on tomatoes and vice versa. In terms of beneficial status of those, I'm trying to think, you know, there are a lot of predators and parasites that might eat them. I would say in general, if they are causing a lot of damage to those flowers, and they're good-sized caterpillars, so they can nibble on plants a lot, maybe just go out and hand-pick them to take care of them, and that's probably going to be enough to take care of the problem on those plants.
Yeah. Thanks, Kathy. Tom in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. My question is regarding, I don't know if you refer to them as a wasp or a hornet. On my house, I'm out in the country, but under every gable of the house, they build nests. They're like a honeycomb shape. You know, they come in and out of the bottom. My propane tank, every time you open the lid, there's a nest under there. You know, they're kind of a long flying looking hornet type thing. Do they sting? I would assume so, but they're not really a big nuisance, but are they beneficial, or are they something that you try to get rid of? Or?
Sure. Great question. And a quick follow-up question for you, Tom. The nests, are you able to look right up into the nests and see that honeycomb-like structure, or are they enclosed more in a paper mache?
No, this is an open.
Okay.
Open honeycomb, not enclosed.
Okay, so in that case, you are seeing paper wasps, or what we call them. There's a bunch of species in our area, and they tend to build these kind of open umbrella-like nests. They're attached by a little stalk, and you can look up and see right into them, and they're often on soffit areas and gable areas. One species, the European paper wasp, likes to get into enclosed cavities, so under the lid of that propane tank and other enclosed spots. They do some bad things. I mean, if you disturb them, they can sting. They'll defend their nest. They can do some good things, though. They can do a little bit of pollination, actually, if they're going to flowers for nectar is a fuel source for them, and a lot of folks don't realize that. They're probably not doing a ton of pollination, but they do a little bit. They're probably best known as being predators, though. They will go out, and they need a protein source to feed to the young in the nest, so they will catch and kill caterpillars and sawflies and things like that. So they can actually be pretty beneficial. If the nest is tucked away and you're not going to bump into it, I tend to leave them so that they'll deal with some of the garden pests for us.
Yeah, makes good sense to me. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, PJ, what are we going to be hearing in the outdoors for insects here in the next month?
Well, a lot of things are going to start to pick up. Some of the insects we talked about on the show today, ants and the yellow jackets, we'll start seeing more and more of those. Japanese beetles we won't see until about 4th of July, give or take. But if you're in a part of the state with sandy soil, those rose chafer beetles will become active. A lot of our caterpillars are already starting to become active, like our tent caterpillars. Gypsy moth is going to be more common in the next couple months. And we'll probably start hearing more insects making noise, and fireflies won't be out before that long either.
Well, I'll tell you what, and you'll be back July 18th, and we'll do this all over again. Thank you so much, PJ.
Sure.
PJ Leish, with degrees in biological sciences and entomology, manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him with us, and he'll be back July 18th. Tomorrow at 11, Mad Dog and Merrill back to talk about getting the grilling season going. Hope you can join us for that at 11:45. We'll talk about the legendary tornado chaser, Tim Samaras. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.